Hello there. Today is Wednesday, November 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, voters have their say in Tuesday's midterm elections, but there's some are still being counted. There are still results, though.
The reason why I'm out here voting today is because I'm doing like what Trump says. We're trying to make America great again.
The U.S. Director of Homeland Security says the elections are secure from foreign compromise. Will Sudan's child soldiers get to go home? Also ahead, pop singer Ariana Grande gets a big award. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, health care and immigration have been high on voters' minds as they cast ballots in the midterm elections, according to a number of surveys, which also show President Trump a factor in the votes. Control of the House and Senate has been at stake, and Democrats are hoping, or were hoping, that they could take both chambers. It does not necessarily look like that's going to happen. In Raleigh, North Carolina, 19-year-old Melvin Ruby, a voter there, said he voted for Democrats today because of Trump's hard line toward immigrants.
I believe it's very sad and very, I feel like that's not what America's all about. Seeing what he said about me, I took it so personal.
And Gary Smith is a Republican in Ohio.
Most of the candidates I favor are lining up behind Trump. And it's not because he's the world's greatest human being. It's because he's effective. He's getting things done. He's doing what he said he was going to do, which is very unusual.
Well, voters in one of the nation's most closely watched governor's races cast ballots amid an ongoing dispute about one of the candidates' management of Georgia's election system, leaving open the possibility supporters on the losing side may not accept the outcome. Joining us now for an update on all the results that we have so far and what they mean is VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Jim, I know you've been watching this closely. First, let's just hear some of the big takeaways so far. We know all the results are not in, and there are still states in the West that haven't, the polls haven't closed. So what do we know so far about the big takeaways?
Democrats are on the verge of delivering a blow to the Donald Trump presidency in the House of Representatives. They are on track, it seems, to probably pick up enough seats to retake the majority in the House of Representatives. That would be a shift in the balance of power in Washington. It would allow the Democrats to, in some cases, block the Trump agenda in the House and launch various oversight investigations. Now, we should point out that the Democrats are picking up House seats, but they don't yet have the 23 gains that they need to retake the House. On the flip side, the battle for the Senate, remember, all 435 House seats are at stake. The Senate's roughly a third. It's only 35 Senate seats. 29 of those are seats defended by Democrats. And 10 of them are in Trump states, Republican states from the 2016 election. There, Democrats have found some disappointment. Democratic incumbents have lost Senate seats in Indiana and North Dakota now. And Republicans have held a Senate seat in Tennessee that was currently held by the retiring chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Bob Corker. On the flip side of that, though, for Democrats, Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia, was reelected. So he was able to hold that. So we're also looking at very close races in Texas, where Ted Cruz has a slight lead over Beto O'Rourke, the Democrat, and in Florida. We're looking at a very close Senate and gubernatorial race, but right now the Republicans have leads in those races.
Were there any surprises that that struck you?
Yeah, there's always going to be, if you look at the polls coming in, Democrats looked like they were trending better in the Senate races, including in Indiana and possibly even in Tennessee. They were at least close. But what's happening here is the red state Senate races seem to be closing for the Republicans. And I think you'll see President Trump claim a lot of credit for that. He focused on those states in the last 2 weeks of the campaign, held a lot of rallies in those states. We still have some states to come in like Missouri and Arizona. We don't know what's going to happen there. But I think there's enough here for the president to claim some electoral prowess. not only for the 2018 midterms, but as he looks ahead to his own reelection campaign in 2020. And let's face it, he will be focused on that aspect of this. He will take from this what he can and what he must and turn it into a positive for his own reelection hopes in 2 years from now.
Is it all at this point pretty much a given that the Democrats will not be able to get enough seats to take the Senate?
It's looking pretty unlikely. They would have to pick up more Senate seats in Republican states, and that's just not terribly likely at the moment. So the loss of Indiana in particular, I think, hurts the Democratic hopes of finding a way to take back a majority in the Senate. Republicans may be able to add a seat or two. This will be important in terms of confirmations of government officials and, of course, judges and even Supreme Court justices if we get into another situation where there is a vacancy on the high court.
How will all of these results impact the next 2 years for Donald Trump's presidency as far as the Democrats at least taking the House?
Look, in the next few days, we're going to be playing the expectations game. OK, so what that means is Democrats may be slightly disappointed that it wasn't a bigger wave than it was. Trump will seize that as basically a minor victory for him, for his agenda, that he's got the country on the right horse, that course, and that he's holding the red states, the Republican states that he would need to win in 2020 for reelection. Democrats are going to be very closely watching the results in the Midwest tonight, because that will be the key to them making a rebound in the presidential race in 2020, if they want to be competitive again and challenge Trump in a significant way.
Would you say that this isn't the message to the president that the Democrats had hoped to send?
Yeah, I don't think it's as broad and as strong in that sense, because they were not able to take this wave and have it crash into the Republican Senate wall as well. So there will be some of that. On the other hand, Democrats are picking up a number of Republican-held House seats. And clearly, a number of them are in suburban districts driven by women voters who are not very happy with the direction of the Trump presidency and are making that known tonight. What Republicans choose to do about that in 2020, I'm not sure. I think the victories in the red Senate seats tonight that were propelled by Trump's appearances will tell him that he's on the right track for 2020 to just simply double down and narrowly focus on his base. Whether that gets him another 4 years in the White House, I don't know, and it could be a risky gamble.
All right. That is VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. We thank you so much for all your expertise on this, and we'll keep watching it.
Thank you.
Well, as Americans flocked to the polling places Tuesday to vote in what's been termed one of the most important midterms, non-presidential elections in U.S. history, there's been major interest around the world. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Tom Nagorski, executive vice president of the New York-based Asia Society, about the interest being expressed there.
I think there's probably more interest, and this parallels, frankly, the interest you're seeing among all Americans as well, but there's... My history doesn't go back that far, but I can't imagine that people in Asia have ever had anything like the interest that they have. They probably didn't even know in some corners what a midterm election was, but I think I'm not out on a limb by saying that it's unprecedented in terms of a midterm election. And I think that's something we have seen reflected since November of 2016 in terms of the interest level in all things that were emanating from the Trump White House, and that's irrespective, frankly, of geography and probably irrespective of point of view, but just the extent to which this administration has scrambled a lot of paradigms and assumptions about policy in Asia, about the United States' place, not just in Asia, but around the world. And, you know, a metric that probably isn't worth anything, but I'll share it anyway, is just the level of interest among Asian diplomats here in New York who want to ask us questions when we're usually the ones asking them questions, given what we do. However you want to look at it, it's sky high, and I'm sure we'll be getting lots of questions and inquiries in the days ahead.
What are the most important issues to the people with whom you speak or with whom you know or what you hear?
I would say to start with, there's interest in something that has nothing to do with a particular policy, but I think people around the world are very interested in the divisions in this country as observers, and I think they're also interested in the extent to which a divided United States has difficulty getting things done, and more specifically, in the current politics of the current White House, is in not all places, but in many parts of the world, far less engaged than it used to be. We are just a few weeks away from the APEC meetings and other critical meetings in Asia, where Mr. Trump himself, the president, has sort of opted out, and you know, that's a that may not be exactly front and center in the minds of most Americans as they go to the polls today. It's obviously a symbol, at least, of something that is of great interest in Asia. Now, looking at actual policies and areas, of course, that will depend a little bit on where on that vast continent you you throw the proverbial dart and who you're asking. But one manageable way to look at it, I think, is to look at the places where Donald Trump's foreign policy has turned upside down the policies of his predecessors and really, in some cases, changed basic understandings that were in place for decades. When you look at policy makers and leaders around Asia, I think there is an interest in knowing whether some stability will come in the years ahead from the United States.
VOA Asia's Ira Melman talking to Tom Nagorski, Executive Vice President of the New York-based Asia Society. The results of the election, as you've been hearing, have shifted some of the balance of power in Washington to potentially alter the next 2 years of Donald Trump's presidency. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security has been working with state and local election officials to make sure the elections are free from tampering from outside actors. VOA's David Byrd spoke with National Security correspondent Jeff Selden, who attended a briefing by the secretary and other officials Tuesday, who talked about how they compared this election to 2016.
This time around, according to Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen and the Undersecretary Chris Krebs, they've seen some scanning, but they call it very much routine, what they would see on a daily basis. And as far as any pattern of attack or coordinated action by the Russians or anybody else, they haven't seen any evidence that that's taken place so far.
There were some accounts in the news of Facebook deleting accounts because of misleading information. Did that come up at this briefing at all?
Right. There are two things that Homeland Security and intelligence officials have been worried about. The first is the actual election infrastructure, and that's where they've not seen any intrusions so far. They have sensors covering about 93% of the voting systems, the databases, the networks, and they haven't seen anything suspicious there. What they do continue to see, although they did not see an uptick with the election, what they do continue to see are these influence operations, primarily by the Russians, but by some other actors as well, Iran, in some ways China, though not as directly tied to the election itself, and that's been ongoing. And so what they were worried about is how that was going to play out. So they're worried about what happens now with the second wave as the polls close and as the results come in and as those results in the days and weeks ahead have to be certified. What happens? What type of influence operations may be coming from Russia to try to convince Americans that their votes and their voices didn't count? So that's where they're focused on at the moment.
And were there any specific measures that they mentioned they were taking to protect the security of the elections?
Well, in terms of the election infrastructure, they've been working for the last 2 years with state and local officials. The federal government's made about $380 million available in funding to upgrade the networks, the systems, the computers, the hardware, to make it more secure, to make sure that you have a paper trail in as many cases as possible. States have been using that money Not all of them are there yet, but they think by 2020 they'll be where they need to be. They also have these sensors. They call them Albert sensors, which can see if somebody's trying to attack or penetrate a system. What they, intelligence officials and independent analysts, have been worried about is what happens on the influence operations side. The government officials say that they've been working better with social media companies to take down bad content, false or inauthentic accounts, either linked to Russia or to Iran. Facebook and Instagram have done that of late. But there's a big concern because every time a new social media platform comes up, there's something new out there to watch for. Election officials have mostly been saying, and intelligence officials, the best defense is a good offense, which means, A, go out and vote is what they're telling Americans. Don't be dissuaded by any text messages or anything else you might see saying that it's not real. Know what sources you're getting your information from and check a variety of sources.
Among the top stories we are covering at VOAnews.com, a study finds a vocal, well-to-do whites are driving U.S. polarization. Four former presidents compete for Madagascar's presidency. A deadly Taliban raid overruns Afghan police base near Iran border. And scientists say rats are causing big damage to the world's coral reefs. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at VOAnews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The special representative of the Secretary General for Children in Armed Conflict says a chief benefit of peace in South Sudan is the likelihood that a great many child soldiers will be freed and reintegrated into their communities. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UN Special Representative Virginia Gamba was present during the Khartoum peace process in South Sudan 3 weeks ago. She met with government officials and members of the various warring factions. She visited the camps where she met and talked with child soldiers. All of this, she says, has convinced her that prospects for the separation and release of children are very high. So far this year, she says 900 child soldiers have been freed. If the peace holds, she says it is possible as many as 1,000 more children will be released by the end of the year. Once they are released, she says they must go through a process of integration, and that, she notes, could be problematic.
The fear I have is that the amount of children that will be released in the next few months are such that UNICEF and partners will not have enough resources to handle the reintegration at one go, which means a lot of children are punished by staying in the bush without the chance of reintegration until we have the capacity to absorb them.
Gamba is appealing to the international community to provide aid agencies with the money they need to reintegrate the child soldiers into their communities so they can be given a fresh start. She says recruitment as soldiers is only one of the many violations to which children are subjected. She says acts of violence against children in South Sudan are the worst she has ever seen, including in Afghanistan and Syria. She says gross violations include decapitation, the use of sexual violence against very small children as a weapon of war, abductions, and the forced use of children to support the war effort. She says all of the warring parties, government and rebel forces alike, are guilty of these crimes and must be held accountable for them. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Well, although a caravan of Central American migrants fleeing violence and extreme poverty remains hundreds of kilometers away from the U.S.-Mexico border, President Trump has begun to station more than 7,000 active-duty troops there in preparation for the arrival. In El Paso, Texas, one possible destination for those seeking asylum, border residents are highlighting a disconnect between optics and reality. VOA's Ramon Taylor reports from West Texas.
It's too early to predict where a caravan of several thousand migrants will end its journey. But with midterm elections near and troops stationed along the U.S.-Mexico border, Texas residents have been drawn into debate on what defines a crisis and what values define them.
I feel like we're welcoming to others, and that's what I like about El Paso.
Family and cultural ties unite residents of West Texas, New Mexico, and Ciudad Juarez in Mexico, where the neighboring communities meet. An annual border mass serves to remember those who have perished seeking refuge. Residents here say they will be ready should the caravan arrive in their city.
They are preparing shelters. People are supporting with food, clothing, with coats, because the cold season is coming.
We know what they're living over there. We know what they're experiencing. They know how they live. They know what they're going through. So when we receive them over here, say, oh, sure.
El Paso holds claim to the safest city in Texas and 7th overall in the U.S. Though in a reliably Democratic county, local supporters of President Trump's efforts to fortify the border and deter the caravan from touching U.S. soil make a case similar to immigration hardliners elsewhere in the country.
If it's 7,000, what prevents them from bringing on another 7,000 and another 7,000? We have to draw a line as to where, how, and how we want to let people in the country.
How you guys doing? Fine, we came down to visit the wall.
President Trump has invoked national security in describing the caravan of would-be asylum seekers trekking through danger in the Gulf Coast state of Veracruz, Mexico. But some longtime residents here call the president's actions and rhetoric a distraction ahead of midterm elections that could provide a check on his authority.
Unless two countries get together, two neighbors, try and get together to solve the problem by insulting them and by putting another fence next to theirs and doing all this stuff, that's not going to help it. You're not going to help anybody.
Ana Perez, a Tigua tribal member of Isleta del Sur Pueblo in Texas, cites the long history of her own sovereign nation.
Not only my nation, but many other Native American nations have been dishonored for centuries. You know, here, we have been here over 300 years on this land. So therefore, why would we feel threatened by someone else?
Ramon Taylor, VOA News, El Paso, Texas.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, managing editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
The 2019 VOA calendars are in. This year's calendar features a variety of scenic photos that capture U.S. byways, including beautiful photos of the Big Sur Coast Highway and even the historic Route 66. Tune in to Border Crossings at 1500 Universal to request a free calendar.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, January will mark the 60th anniversary of the founding of Motown Records, which became world famous for its distinct sound and star performers such as Michael Jackson, Diana Ross, Marvin Gaye, and numerous others. The Detroit-based company was topping the charts of the record charts during the 60s, and its success continued after a move from Detroit to Los Angeles a little over a decade later. Motown Records was sold in 1994 and now operates under a parent company, but its name has become a symbol of an important era in American music. VOA's Larica Hope reports on Detroit's efforts to build its legacy as a Motown city.
Detroit is making efforts to recover from years of economic decline, and reminding people of the city's music heritage is a large part of it. Detroit's main library provides space for local musicians to breathe new life into half-a-century-old Motown classics. Abdul Duke Fakir is an original member of the Four Tops.
There's got to be some kind of way that, that the Motown story and music can stay alive in Detroit. I mean, we were just as important to Detroit as cars.
One of the leaders of the crusade to revive the Motown genre, a blend of soul and pop, is singer Joan Belgrave, the widow of star trumpet player Marcus Belgrave.
There's no place that's dedicated to that genre, and this is Detroit. And people are shocked, honestly.
The Motown Museum in Detroit displays photographs from the company's golden era and is planning a major expansion. Some of the city's streets are getting named after famous Motown stars such as Michael Jackson. And there is an effort to build a nightclub industry centered around the Motown sound. One of the company's greatest stars was Washington-born Marvin Gaye. His fans say his music resonates today as much as it did 40 years ago.
The more spiritual part of Marvin is that which I've clung to the most, what's going on, inner city blues. So as I'm listening to the song right now, I'm thinking about all the things that's happening in the world, that's happening in this country right now, and he was talking about it then, and it's relevant now.
When Berry Gordy founded Motown Records in January of 1959, he had no idea that he would become a celebrity himself. His autobiography was the basis for Motown the Musical that hit Broadway in 2013 and London 2 years later.
I wanted to tell the story of what Motown was all about. No. I wanted to tell the story of how it felt, you know, the wins and the losses and triumphs and the disasters that happened along the way and how it was that I happened to come up with it.
The West End musical is currently on a year-long tour of Britain and Ireland. Gordy says he set out to make good music not just for black people, but for the whole world. Detroit wants to remind the world where it all started. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists have wondered what Oumuamua, the first interstellar object to visit our solar system, was. Was it an asteroid, comet, a new cosmic body, or perhaps an alien space probe? When it was discovered a little over a year ago, astronomers noticed the object moving away from the sun faster than expected. If it were a comet, a process called outgassing could have caused the increased speed. But Oumuamua lacked cometary traits like a coma or tail. A pair of scientists at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics proposes the increased acceleration was the result of radiation pressure from the sun. If so, because of its odd, thin shape, the scientists suggest, among many possibilities, that Oumuamua may be a light sail of artificial origin. Light sails propelled by solar radiation have been proposed to send CubeSats into deep space. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You love it.
Well, the music industry is honoring Ariana Grande. Billboard on Tuesday named the 25-year-old award-winning singer its 2018 Woman of the Year. Grande will receive the award at Billboard's 13th annual Women in Music event on December 6th in New York City. Previous recipients include Taylor Swift, Lady Gaga, Madonna, and Selena Gomez. In a statement, Billboard's vice president of content, Ross Garano, says Grande consistently stands up for herself and her decisions in a world that often isn't hospitable to that sort of strength in young women. In the past, Grande has had top 40 hits, including No Tears Left to Cry, Breathin', and God is a Woman. She helped organize the One Love Manchester concert last year, raising more than $23 million for victims of the Manchester bombing. And you have been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you very much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
This is VOA News.